Welcome to Spruce Grove Alliance Church, your home.
If you haven't noticed, there is this thing coming later this month called Christmas. Yes, society likes to remind us of this back in November. It is December 1st today, believe it or not. And as we sit at the cusp of this thing called the Christmas season, before we get into the heart of it, which can sometimes be a little bit chaotic and complex and hectic, I want to get our trajectory right. Is it just me, or can sometimes we make the Christmas season too chaotic and cluttered and complicated? You know, it can feel a bit like a Where's Waldo picture, where Waldo's in there somewhere. Jesus is in that mess somewhere. He's kind of eclipsed by something in there, and we add all of this superfluous stuff to Christmas. It becomes chaotic and cluttered and complicated as we add parties and presents and pageants and decorating and dining and debt. And sometimes we come to the end of the Christmas season, and if you're like me, you're like, what was that? We just added so much stuff to this thing, and that wasn't a break. There was no peace on earth in that thing. That was chaos. It was hectic. It was complicated. I found this funny poem that's kind of a spoof off of the famous "'Twas the Night Before Christmas." It's called "'Twas the Day After Christmas." Perhaps some of you can identify with this. Just bear with me. It says, "'Twas the day after Christmas when all through the place there were arguments and depression. Even Mom had a long face. The stockings hung empty and the house was a mess. The new clothes didn't fit and Dad was under stress. The family was irritable and the children no one could please because the instructions for the swing set were written in Chinese. The bells no longer jingled and no carolers around. The sink was stacked with dishes and the tree was turning brown. The stores were full of people returning things that fizzled and failed, and the shoppers were discouraged because everything they'd bought was now half-price sale. 'Twas the day after Christmas. The spirit of joy had disappeared. The only hope in the horizon was the world junior hockey we could cheer. And sometimes we can just make the Christmas season so chaotic and cluttered and complicated, and it becomes like a Where's Waldo picture where Jesus is in there somewhere, and we fill it up with all these parties and presents and pageants and decorating and dining and debt, and ironically, there's no peace on earth. Or like the innkeeper, we just don't have enough room for Jesus as we get caught up in all of this hype. I had a friend who told me this true story is how he got caught up in the hype during the Christmas season. He went to one of those Boxing Day door crasher sales that you all have heard of at an electronics store. And it was a time where he had to line up early in the morning, you know, those lines that are a couple hundred yards long. So he got there really early. He didn't really want to go, but he had a friend who was in a wheelchair that wanted to get something on those kind of lost leaders that they put out. And, you know, they lose money on them, but they want you in the door, you know what I'm saying? But he was going to try and get one of those lost leaders. And so his friend was in a wheelchair. He didn't want him to get kind of trampled or forgotten about in the whole of the chaos. And so he was going to go with him and help him get one of the items that he wanted. So they got there super early at this electronics store on Boxing Day. And as he was looking through the flyer, he admitted he got caught up in all the hype of, wow, that's a good deal. Wow, that's a good deal. And then the doors open and then they stampede in, and his friend in the wheelchair, he gets his thing, is a camera or something like that. And then he noticed that all kinds of people were just converging and bottlenecking at this one display in the middle of the store. And so he gets caught up and he just wedges himself in and he grabs this one of the last boxes off this pallet and he holds it close to his chest. He said, these five guys looked at him as if like vultures. He said, "If you drop that, I'm going to devour it." And he held it to his chest like, "Mine." And no word of lie, this is exactly what he did. He walked down the aisle like this and he goes, "What do I got here?" And doesn't that sum it up? Like, we get caught up in the hype of this thing. that the world says we need to clamor and grasp after something at Christmas time. And in the end, we don't even know what we're clamoring after. We don't even know what we're grasping after, right? We make it so chaotic and cluttered and complicated. Well, as we sit at the cusp of this potentially hectic season, I want this year to be different. When we read the Christmas story in the Bible, we see that it's absolutely drenched with simplicity. What we call the traditional Christmas story is found between two gospel accounts, Matthew and Luke. Mark doesn't talk about the incarnation much. He's in a hurry to get Jesus onto the cross. And John, he doesn't talk about kind of the human aspects of Jesus' birth. He's more of the theological, ontological perspectives, the word becoming flesh, the light coming in the darkness. We looked at that last year. But Matthew and Luke, you take their two accounts. Matthew covers Joseph's details of Joseph's life, Jesus' earthly father, and the Magi. And then Luke has Mary's details of Mary's life and the shepherds. And you blend those two accounts together, and we get what we know as the traditional Christmas story, which is displayed on stages of thousands and if not millions of churches around the world this time of year. The traditional Christmas story, Mary, Joseph, shepherds, and wise men, no room at the end, all that story. And so today what I'd like to do is I'd like to read just a little bit of Luke and just to read a little bit of Matthew, and we'll come back to these larger portions of these stories in the weeks to come. And I want us to see that there's this simplicity in this Christmas story amidst perhaps a chaotic and cluttered, complex world. Let's go to Luke. In those days, doesn't it just start like a simple story, like once upon a time? In those days, Caesar Augustus, who would have been the world leader of the day, leader of Rome, issued a decree that a census with a tax should be taken of the entire Roman world. We'll talk about that. And this was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, where he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who he is pledged to be married to him, an expecting child. And while they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in clothes and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room or room for them at the inn. Later on, after the shepherds happen, the shepherds come and they worship. We'll talk about that in a couple weeks. And then we have this account. On the eighth day, when it was time to circumcise the child, he was named Jesus, the name the angel had given him before he was conceived. When the time came for the purification rites required by the law of Moses, Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As is written in the law of the Lord, every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice in keeping what is said with the law, a pair of doves and two young pigeons. And when they had gone, the angel appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. So this is in Matthew, that says Luke, but this is in Matthew. So this is the Magi just happened, okay? And so when the Magi had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up and take the child and go to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. And when Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. And he gave orders to kill the boys in Bethlehem and his vicinity, who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned of the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice heard in Ramah, weeping, great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. After Herod had died, an angel of the Lord appeared to dream in Joseph in Egypt. He said, get up, take the child and the mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead. So he got up, took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he had heard Archelaus was reigning in Judah, he placed the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. And so it was fulfilled through the prophet that he would be called a Nazarene. Now, there is some very simple aspects to the Christmas story that are mixed with a layer of complexity and chaos that the world is going on, if you've noticed. I want to tell you something a little bit about my origin that I haven't told you yet. This is a chair. You haven't noticed? This is a chair that if it was perhaps in a storage room around here, because we're doing a lot of purging, if it was in another room, it would probably be tossed to the dumpster. It has probably no value to anyone, but it has a lot of sentimental value to me. This belonged to my great, 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 three greats grandfather, John Freeman McKenna. So this is pre-Confederation of Canada around the 1850s. That's a painting of him. That's not a picture of him. He was a circuit-riding pastor on the south shore of Nova Scotia, pastored three little churches, Lewishead, that's one of them, it's still standing, Sable River, and Rockland, which even doesn't exist anymore. And he pastored this and these places, and this chair was his chair. This was, they don't make things like they used to. This isn't particle board from South Asia. This would have been his office chair that he would have, as a pastor, sat in and talked to people and prepared sermons. And so my mom has 11 brothers and sisters on her family side, and I have about 75 cousins on that side of the family, and I'm one of like two or three pastors in the family. And so this was handed down to me because I'm one of the pastors. And so my great-great-great-grandfather, John McKenna, owned this chair. And so my great-grandmother, which I know, she lived to 103, and I remember she would tell stories about how in those days the congregation gathered together, and she would say they cobbled together a parsonage for him. Everyone brought like wood and stuff from shipwreck material, and they built him a house. And they would pay their pastor in produce and chickens, bring them on Sunday. Don't get any ideas. And this right here was a captain's chair off of a shipwreck that they repurposed and they reused. And so this would have been his. And this was, my grandmother used this for about 50 years as an actual chair in her house. Didn't, you know, it was no sentimental value to her. It was just utility value for her. And it was at a desk in one of their children's home in their bedroom. And so they used it for 50 years. And then when she passed on and they moved all their stuff, this kind of came available and it got handed to me. And so every once in a while when the call of ministry gets a little chaotic and complex and cluttered, every once in a while I have a sit in this chair and I realize he was a lot shorter than I was. But he had hair, so it was a bit trade-off there. But somehow God uses this to recenter me on simple things. It was a simpler way of life back then. But this simple wooden primitive structure reminds me of my humble beginnings. You know, Jesus too had a simple primitive wooden structure that reminds us of his beginnings as well. In fact, he had two. One that reminds us of his entrance and one that reminds us of his exit. But this manger, which is probably known all throughout the world as a symbol of Jesus at Christmas time, is kind of like a gateway symbol that helps us understand all of the different aspects, the simple aspects of the Christmas story. In fact, in 1 Corinthians, there's this chunk of verses that captures the whole essence of the simple aspects of this incarnation. God chose the foolish things of this world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of the world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are. And the Christmas story exemplifies those two little verses in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. The original Christmas story is marked by simplicity, and the manger is a symbol of that, the primitive, simple wooden structure. I mean, just look at the simple aspects in the Christmas story. There's a simplicity to the people and to the places. And maybe we're so familiar to this thing called the Christmas story, but we don't even realize it. But Jesus came to, shall I say, simple people, not in a demeaning way, but he came to insignificant people, ordinary people, nobodies, according to the world standards. No celebrities, no royalty, no rich, no political figures, no people with massive amounts of influence. Mary and Joseph. And what is their response each time the angel comes? Like, who am I? Like, who am I to even do this calling that you have on my life? I mean, say what you want about Mary and Joseph, but customs were that they were probably just teenagers. Mary certainly was a teenager. Joseph might have been in his early 20s, according to customs of the day. But they didn't have a lot of life experience. I read this interesting quote by Mark Twain. He said this: "When I was a boy of 15, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I turned 22, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years." We've all been there, right? We think we know it all, right? There's this book in the Old Testament called Proverbs. And it's written from a perspective of a father to a son. And how many times in there does it say, "Listen, my son. Listen, my son. I have advice to share with you about finances, about relationships, about how to use your tongue, about life in general," right? Somebody once said that Proverbs is like being stuck in a car with your mom on a long road trip. Because it's like little pieces of information here, because listen, my son, or it was written by Anufi, yes, my son. There's little pieces of information to someone who doesn't have a lot of life experience. Say what you want about Mary and Joseph. They were just adolescents with not a lot of life experience. Yes, they had a humble heart, and we're going to talk about that, but they didn't have a lot of life experience. But there's this other small detail of this story that we just kind of glossed over, but if the Jewish readers read it at the time, that would just explode in their mind. There was a small detail about their economic status. You see, after the child was born, about 40 days after the child was born, the mother had to go through some purification rites, and she would come to the temple and offer a sacrifice and then dedicate the child. And according to the Old Testament law in Leviticus, they were supposed to purchase a lamb and then offer that as a sacrifice. But there was this footnote as a caveat for the poor. If you were poor and you couldn't afford a lamb, you were allowed to purchase 2 doves or 2 pigeons. And so what does Mary and Joseph purchase? Just think about this for a second. The first caregivers of the King of Kings are poverty-stricken teenagers with no life experience. And that's the people that God chooses to bring the hope of the world through and care for them, for him. And then what about the shepherds and the magi? We're going to talk about them at length in a couple weeks. But shepherds, they were almost beggars. They were the lowest in society. Their word was not even considered viable in a court of law. They were considered liars and thieves. The shepherds, the first to come and worship, the first, the people in the scripture that see the largest angel spectacle in the whole entire Bible. The lowest in society, put it this way. When my kid was little, they used to have career day at school, and they would dress up like someone that they want to be when they grow up. Doctor, or policeman, or fireman, or a veterinarian. No Jewish boy in those days would dress up like a shepherd. I want to be a shepherd when I grow up. High aspiration. No. They were the lowest of society. And yet these are the first people that God graces to come and worship the Christ child and the Magi. How on earth did they get parachuted into the Christmas story? We're so familiar to it. Like, oh yeah, the Magi, the wise men, yeah. We don't even know where they're from. We don't even know their name. These obscure guys from the East, right? Those people from the East out there, way out there. Those East people. If a Jewish person was to craft a story themselves about the hope of the world, which all of the Old Testament speaks about, which is trying to bring to crescendo about Christ, they would not include these obscure nobodies way out there from the East. But yet somehow they are into the Christmas story. See, Jesus came to simple, insignificant nobodies. But he also came to simple, insignificant places. Bethlehem. Bethlehem, actually, we sing about that, O little town of Bethlehem, which is prophesied by the prophet Micah. You're tiny, this little nothing village. You're going to have someone come to you, which is going to be ruler over all of Israel. Bethlehem simply means house of bread. It was a little tiny agricultural community, the breadbasket of the area. And I find it really ironic that Jesus called himself the bread of life, that the bread of life was born in the house of bread. But then there's Nazareth, as you notice in the story. They settled, Joseph was from Nazareth. They ended up resettling back in Nazareth. They went and lived in this town of Nazareth. So he would be called a Nazarene. Now that's not a prestigious term. That's actually a derogatory term, Nazarene. And we even see that later on in Jesus' life where Philip and Nathanael have this conversation as brothers. And Philip's like, hey, come and see this guy, which I've heard is kind of the hope of the world, which all the Old Testament points towards. And Nathanael's response, you remember, is like, Nazareth, can anything good come from there? I mean, every society has their group of people which they have these tongue-in-cheek jokes about. Those people from the East, right? Those Maritimers, and we Maritimers have a good sense of humor. We have some good, we can tell some good jokes about ourselves. So this past summer, I heard a really good joke about, you want to hear a joke about Maritimers? The Maritimer told me this, okay? So there were three Albertans that were, no, three Canadians that were running from the police. One was Albertan, one was an Ontarian, one was a Maritimer. They were running from the police. They go down this dead-end alley, and they notice that there's three sacks there, so they jump in all three sacks to hide from the police, and the police come along, and the Maritimer telling me this, and the police come over, and they see these three sacks, and they're looking for three guys, and so they kick the first sack with a guy from Alberta in it, and the guy goes, meow, and so the police is like, oh, it's just a sack of cats, all right? And then the police go to the second one, and they kick it. The guy from Ontario's in there, and he goes, ruff, 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 ruff. And he goes, oh, it's a sack of dogs. And then he goes to the next sack, and it's the Maritimer, and he gives it a kick, and the Maritimer goes, potato! And so in Jesus' day, the joke would have gone, there was a Judean, a Galilean, and a Nazarene all running from the police, right? To say that Jesus was a Nazarene was a bit of a derogatory term. It was kind of looked down upon in those days. And that's where Jesus is from. He's the place where is the brunt of tongue-in-cheek jokes. And a manger. These feeding trough for animals in a barn. I don't know if any of you have a barn, if you've ever thought of renting it out as a maternity ward. You could put a sign on Facebook, childbirth the Jesus way. Not a place you'd really want to have that happen. But just think about this for a moment, that God owns it all. He has all wealth available to him. He can make something from nothing. And he can make as much of something from nothing that he wants. And he can choose any circumstance to enter our world. And these are the simple, humble circumstances that he uses. And he comes to our world. Don't ever think that God doesn't want you or God can't use you because you're a nobody from nowhere. Because if you see the rest of the book, that's pretty much the narrative of everyone that he uses and wants. Don't ever think that God doesn't want you or God can't use you because you're a nobody from nowhere. Jesus came to simple, insignificant nobodies, to simple, insignificant places, to a complex and chaotic world marred by sin. If you notice there were some chaotic, cluttered complexity to the world. You could say it was a bit of a snarl. I've used this before, talking about everyone has a snarl within, but the whole political climate during Jesus' time, there couldn't have been a more unstable, complex time in the world where Jesus was born into. Rome ruled the world. In those days, the ruler of the world says, hey, there's going to be a census, which is a cloak for, hey, we're going to tax you. And the Jews absolutely hated the Romans. I don't know if you've ever seen Corner Gas. Remember, they live in Dog River, and there's that other town down the road named Woolerton. Yes, and they spit. Well, in Jewish time, when they would mention the Romans, they'd be spit, and if they were the swearing type, they'd add all these expletives to the Romans. They couldn't stand the Romans. The Romans were these oppressive rulers. And so think about this picture for a moment, that the whole world is in travel mode because they can't do this online. They have to go back to their hometown village where they were born. And Joseph has to go back to Bethlehem. The world is in this chaotic, dangerous traveling mode. And they're going home not to visit family. Yes, they're going to see family, but they're going to kick rocks the whole way home because they have to pay taxes to their oppressors to continue their oppression on them. I mean, everyone hates paying taxes, and everyone complains about how the government pays taxes, but more so in those times. Just think about that. So Nazareth to Bethlehem was 130 kilometers. It took about a week, and Mary is great with child. And there's no room at the inn, and they have to go, and she's born in a manger. But there's another level of chaos that this text highlights. The Romans placed these puppet kings or these pseudo kings in power to govern each of these nations that they overtook, and they were a bit hands off, and it let them have a bit autonomy. Their job of these pseudo kings was to keep the peace, to keep everyone loyal to Rome, and to keep the money flowing to Rome. As long as they kind of did that, they let them kind of do their own thing. And so for the Jewish people, they set up the Herods, or Herod the Great, or as some call him, Herod the Not So Great. And here's one of the most ironic things about Herod the Great, who could charge his own provincial sales tax on top of the federal tax, and he could take as much as he wanted. Not 5 kilometers away from that manger in Bethlehem, which would be like here to the edge of Stony Plain, he built this no expense spared beautiful palace called Herodium. Pools and dining rooms and gardens, where you could entertain guests, all the luxury that you could ever imagine. Such a juxtaposition. He was this ragingly insecure man that he would end up killing people, even in his family, if he thought that they were eyeing his throne. And we see this in the Christmas story, that when he realized he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. He was this ragingly insecure loose cannon of a king. And what does he do? He ends up killing all these babies in Bethlehem, and Mary and Joseph have to flee to Egypt to get away from this ragingly insecure leader. But it gets even snarlier after that. Not long after that whole massacre of the baby boys, Herod is so worried that, or he gets deathly ill, and he is so worried that no one is going to mourn his death, because he knows everyone doesn't like him in Israel, that he orders at the moment that he dies that some prominent popular Jewish people be killed at that moment. So at least there'll be some mourning in Israel. That's just sadistic. We see that in Josephus wrote about that in extra biblical literature. Rome didn't let that happen. At the moment that Herod the Great died, they stepped in and they ended up they split his kingdom into 3 parts. And they gave it to 3 of his sons, Herod Antipas, Herod Archelaus, and Herod Philip. Okay. Herod Antipas is in Judea and Samaria. Herod Archelaus is in Judea and Samaria. Antipas is in Galilee, and Herod Philip is in the east. We don't hear about Herod Philip in the Bible. Herod Archelaus and Herod Antipas, we do. Archelaus, he was ruthless like his father, a loose cannon. He once crucified 3,000 people just to squash an uprising. So Rome saw Archelaus as a liability. He couldn't keep the peace. And so they removed him and they replaced him with governors, Roman governors, one being Pontius Pilate. If you ever remember in the crucifixion story, you remember the crucifixion story where he goes to Pilate and Pilate's like, wait a second, you're from Herod Antipas's? When he punts him to Herod, Herod punts him back to Pilate because I can't kill a guy. Herod Antipas is the most prominent one in the New Testament. He ends up killing John the Baptist, and he interviewed Jesus on way to the cross. And we see this chaotic complexity of this snarl in the whole Christmas story when it says that when Joseph heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. He's just like his father. In place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there, and he went and lived in the town of Nazareth. So in those days, it was like, pick your poison. Where do you want to live? Which Herod are you going to live under? Pick your poison. It was a complex, unstable, chaotic world marred by sin. Hate for other nationalities, crushing oppressive taxes, manipulating national leaders, spending money on themselves, unpredictable national leaders posturing with their power, refugees fleeing for their life, violence, oppression, uprisings, turmoil, poverty, and greed. It's a good thing that none of that happens today. If we think we've been looking at history, we are mistaken. To quote myself out of context, this is us. Mark Twain once said, again, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. I'll hunt sometimes out towards Gibbons, where I used to pastor, and there were these two chicken farms of these guys in my church that used to let me hunt on their property. And they would push out hundreds of thousands of chickens out of these barns. And so behind the barns is these piles of manure that would be the size of your house. And every once in a while when I walk back there, the wind blows just the right way and it catches my nose. And I just, that putrid stench just catches my nose and I want to throw up. And then I'll go to the other chicken farm and there's another big pile of chicken manure. And then the wind blows the right way and I'll catch a whiff of that and I want to throw up. Two chicken farms, two piles of manure. If we think we've been looking at history, we've been mistaken, for we're looking at ourselves. Can I say it this way? Same crap, different pile? See, Jesus came to simple, insignificant people, to simple, insignificant places, to a complex world marred by sin, with a simple yet significant message. Give him the name Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. You know, when God was going to do something special or he would change the direction of someone's life, he would give them a new name, or he would give them a new name of his own self. Or he would tell the prophet, name your child this because I'm going to do something different. Or he would change the direction of someone's life in the Bible. He would change their name, like Abraham, Sarai, Sarah, Israel, Jacob. He changes to Israel. Saul, he changes to Paul. And so when God's going to do something new, God's going to do something different, he gives someone a name. Jesus simply means God is salvation. God saves. And the truth is, we are all simple, insignificant people mixed up in the chaos and complexity of our own sin. To blend our illustrations, we've all added to the snarl. We've all added to the dung pile that's made it more chaotic, that's made it more cluttered, that's made it more complex. Jesus came into the mess of our world to save us. I once heard of a pastor that was kind of tired of all of the chaos and the cluttered and complexity of Christmas, and sometimes the church can add to it, and the overdone decorations. And so he said, all I want this Christmas is just a pile of manure on stage. And he preached from a pile of manure. I thought about it, but then I decided I wanted to keep my job. He talked about how Jesus came to the messed up part of our lives to save us. There's a video, a music video that I'd like us to watch here to hopefully set us on the right trajectory this Christmas season. It's circulated the past few years over social media, and it reminds me of the simple message of Christmas. And it's a retake off of an old Christmas carol, O Come All Ye Faithful, and they've inverted it, O Come All You Unfaithful. O come all you unfaithful, it goes on to talk about, you weak and unstable, you barren and you waiting, you weary and you praying, you bitter and broken, you guilty and you hiding. O come all you unfaithful, Christ is here for you. There is peace promised for those who believe in the chaos, the complexity, and the cluttered mess of our world. And that's the simple message of Christmas. Christ is here for you. So as we sit at the cusp of this Christmas season, let the message of this song set us on the right trajectory. Because the message is simple, really. Christ is here for you. Have a look.
Unspoken.
Thanks for listening to this week's message from Spruce Grove Alliance Church. For more information or to hear past messages, please visit sgac.net.